Okay, here we go. Stand by.
3, 2, 1.
The Thinking Atheist. It's not a person. It's a symbol. An idea.
The population of atheists in this country is going through the roof.
Rejecting faith. Pursuing knowledge. Challenging the sacred.
If I tell the truth, it's because I tell the truth. Not because I put my hand on a book and made a wish.
And working together for a more rational world.
Take the risk of thinking for yourself. Much more happiness, truth, beauty, and wisdom will come to you that way.
Assume nothing. Question everything. And start thinking. This is the Thinking Atheist Podcast, hosted by Seth Andrews.
I'm honored to have on the broadcast Dr. Terry Daniel. Now, there's a lot of credits here, so let me see if I get all these right. The founder of the Conference on Death, Grief, and Belief. That's coming up July 15th through the 17th in Portland. There's a website for that, deathgriefandbelief.com. Dr. Daniel is an end-of-life advisor, an interfaith chaplain, and her work focuses on bereavement and trauma supports. How'd I do, Dr. Daniel? Did I get
that
close on
perfect.
That?
Okay. Very, very good.
So, what is an end-of-life advisor? I mean, I think I know, but explain it for me.
Well, basically, I work with people who have a terminal diagnosis and hopefully are preparing for end of life. You know, they've accepted the prognosis and they're making plans on how they want their end of life to be. Now, of course, not everybody gets that opportunity to create the deathbed scene that they want, or to close up all their affairs and their business and say goodbye to people and pay their bills and do all that. But some people put a high value on being able to do that. So I help with that. But mostly nowadays, I'm more involved in the actual process of dying in my work as a hospice chaplain. And I think it might be interesting and important to define what an interfaith hospice chaplain is. When you say the word chaplain, people immediately think of Father Mulcahy from MASH, right? Catholic priest with a big cross and a, you know, collar and a Bible. And the progressive chaplains, we hate that term, and we're working on finding a new one. But what a chaplain is absolutely not a minister or a pastor. A chaplain is somebody who is supposed to be religiously neutral, and we work with people in hospitals, in hospice. Of course, there are police chaplains and military chaplains. There are even corporate chaplains. And we're supposed to walk in religiously neutral, regardless of what our own religious or non-religious perspectives might be. We leave that outside the door and we go in and we help people manage whatever spiritual questions or crises or whatever they have as they face either their death or the death of somebody close to them. And it's very controversial because there are plenty of places that you will find where the chaplains don't respect this neutrality requirement and will go in and preach and evangelize at patients. And they're definitely not supposed to do that.
Yeah, I mean, if I may jump in, I can't imagine a Catholic priest walking in and, you know, there's a devout Muslim who is about to pass away and they engage in a Muslim ritual.
Well, you would not see a Catholic priest doing that. And that's interesting in chaplaincy because Catholics are in a whole separate category because they do have so many rigid, you know, ceremonial and ritual requirements and things that they're not allowed to do. So the Catholic chaplains are in a category by themselves. If we have a Catholic patient that wants Catholic rituals, we call a Catholic priest. We don't really do that. But yes, a regular chaplain like me, I would absolutely engage in a Muslim ritual, a Jewish ritual, a Hindu ritual, whatever somebody wants. However, generally, you know, a Muslim patient would prefer to have their own imam come in, or a Muslim chaplain. But we have Buddhist chaplains and we have atheist chaplains.
Yeah, that's a sort of a mind bender for a lot of people. And I think there's a resistance to it. I mean, I used to think atheist chaplain, well, this plays into this this lie that atheism is itself a religion. We have chaplains. But I've modified my own perspective on that. I mean, at the end of life, if you want someone to come and be at your bedside or to counsel or even just be with you, you know, a flesh and blood human being to sit with you during those critical hours, I mean, I can go there with chaplain. What's your perspective on the atheist chaplain?
Well, chaplaincy isn't necessarily about religion. And for me in particular, my training is in counseling. So when I go in there, I'm really there as a counselor. And I use those skills and that kind of training, which transcends all religious boundaries. You probably know about, I can't think of his name, but he was interviewed by NPR multiple times, an atheist chaplain in the military. And he is there because there are atheists in foxholes.
Yeah.
And there's tons of them in the military. And who are they going to talk to when they've just killed someone or witnessed a trauma and they don't want to talk to the religious chaplain? So there's a huge demand for that. One of the things I do when I was working in a hospital as a chaplain, I'd walk into a patient's room. Hello, I'm Terry. I'm the chaplain. Would you like a visit today? And they would say, oh, no, no, I don't believe in God. And I would say, good, I don't believe in that God either. And then they would laugh and then we would have a conversation.
So, I mean, are you wearing some sort of a chaplain attire or something? Or, I mean, I don't know. I mean, are you wearing a robe and a collar of some kind? Or?
No, I usually wear scrubs, actually, especially since COVID. I look just like a nurse.
Wow. You know?
No, we don't wear any sort of attire.
All right, so here's a hot button word. I don't think it should be. And again, in my own life, I think I've allowed for more latitude on the word spiritual. You know, I'm not religious, but I am spiritual. And, and when I think spiritual in my brain, I tend to think, oh, spirits or ghosts or, you know, something off in the ether that's invisible and unmeasurable, you know, the spirit, spiritual. How do you tackle the word spiritual in your own life?
I am so glad you brought that up. And, you know, just like the word chaplain, language is a bitch. Semantics are so problematic. So when you think of spiritual, you think of spirits and ghosts. And all these words are troublesome. And I'm really glad you brought this up because I do a lot of atheist podcasts and I'm very involved in the atheist world. But I do not identify myself as an atheist because there is no one clear meaning about that. So there is an atheist purity test that I've come across a lot, which is, you know, we don't believe in deities and gods, of course, but we also don't believe in anything non-physical or metaphysical or mystical. There's only the three-dimensional physical world, the materialist, empiricist world, and there's nothing outside of that. To me, that's like, you know, this orthodox atheism. And I'm on the middle, in the edge of that someplace, you know, because I am aware of non-physical dimensions. I do think that our awareness, our consciousness can be in many dimensions, not just the one that is contained inside the body. The thing is that those dimensions have no religious context, and it's the religious context that we hate, you know, the dogma and the doctrine and the narrative and the mythology interpreted literally. That's where the problems are. And I find this, and that's one of the things that I'm trying to do with this conference that I'm producing, is bring the whole, both ends of the spectrum together. Like, you can be an extreme woo-woo person, you know, and you believe in, you know, crystals and mediums and all that on one end, and then you can be an empiricist science atheist on the other end. And I don't think there's going to be too many of the extreme woo-woo people at the conference, but is there a place in the middle where we can meet, where we can say that, you know, there is research on things like near-death experience as a hospice worker. I've seen people have these experiences, but there's no heaven with pearly gates and Jesus and God in the sky involved in any of that. So, you know, can we consider that spiritual but not religious, you know, addresses a sort of neutral, non-physical dimension, period?
You lost me at metaphysical, and I'll tell you why. I mean, and I'd like to flesh this out a little bit. But I remember when Christopher Hitchens had his esophageal cancer, was going through chemo, but he saw the writing on the wall and he knew that, you know, this is probably it. And he was doing a last spate of interviews out there, a last series of interviews, and people would ask him, you know, do you think there's something after this life? And I think his answer was the honest one. Like, I haven't seen any evidence for any life after, but I don't know. And in his words, he said, I rather like surprises. And I think, you know, I haven't seen any evidence that there is something out there. It's not that I don't think in the atheist movement we are saying it's totally impossible, but we're waiting to see the evidence for it. And when you talk about NDEs or near-death experiences, how do you differentiate between someone who saw the white light and spoke with grandma or whatever in some other plane? How do you differentiate that from, say, hypoxia, you know, lack of oxygen to the brain? I mean, it's all really a subjective thing. How do you approach that? What I consider to be a problematic word, which is metaphysics or metaphysical.
Yeah, well, metaphysical has a bad rap in the last couple of decades because it's been attached to the New Age theology and extreme woo. And so it's kind of a scratchy word. But I really I'm really delighted to hear that Hitchens said that, you know, that he said, I don't know, you know, whatever. I like surprises.
Yeah.
The best thing I learned in 10 years of training as a theologian, which technically I am, is how to say I don't know. I don't fucking know.
That's an honest answer. I think it takes a lot of courage, you know, because if you come out of a fundy faith, any high control religion, certainly, you know, this whole idea, well, I don't have the answer, is an expression of weakness in their minds. Of course, you know, being assured, knowing with a capital K,
yes.
You know, having the truth with a capital T. If you don't know, well, then you don't know what you're talking about. To be able to say, well, I don't have the answer to that, that actually takes a lot of courage.
Well, it took me a lot of years and a lot of exploration to finally arrive at that. And one of my favorite professors in theology school said it perfectly to me. He said, when talking about theology, nobody knows what they're talking about. So the enemy is certainty, right? The enemy is absolutism, and that's what you get in religious fundamentalism. This is absolutely true. There is no questioning. We know this to be true with a capital K, and that's where the danger comes in. That's where people become fanatics. That's where we lose our critical thinking skills, and that's how we end up, you know, victims of toxic theology and religious abuse, is that certainty. I mean, imagine if you were raised in this fundy household, but yet your parents said to you, you know, this is what we believe, we're really into this, but you don't have to do it. You know, they said, you know, go hang out with the Buddhist kid down the street and see if you can learn something from him. I mean, how different would that have been?
I think where you and I really do line up is this idea that, and I have heard atheists say, and I get what they're doing when they say there is no God, meaning that I think many of them mean, well, we haven't seen evidence for any God with a capital G, with a proper name relating to a specific theistic religion. I mean, I get that. Like, I know there is no Yahweh because I've seen the Bible deconstructed. But I think if we say, I don't believe there is a God because I haven't seen any evidence, I mean, I buy that, but I'm not going to make a declarative statement that there might not be something out there, I don't know, somewhere. I mean, is that fair from your perspective?
Yeah. And again, you know, language is the problem. So if you look at, for example, you know, academic research that's been done on religiosity, like you've seen the current Pew forums, which are just excellent, you know, just showing that numbers of church attendance and religious identification are just plummeting, which is great news. But if you look at other research, the way they do it is they ask questions that go nowhere, like, do you believe in God? Do you go to church? And if anyone ever asked me, do you believe in God? I would say, well, what do you mean by God? Because I'm not going to be able to, no, I can't, you know, I don't believe in man in the sky, Yahweh, warrior, God, psychopath. You know, no, of course I don't believe in that. I don't believe in any, you know, supreme being. But I do believe that there's some sort of, you know, there are energetic forces that we can't see or define. Now, do those cause things to happen to us? No. You know, do they have judgments? Is this force, is, you don't have any judgment about it? No, it's just a neutral force of creation, like the Big Bang. The Big Bang is God, right? Time is God. I mean, just, you know, energy moving forward. That's about as far as I would ever go with a belief in God, but it's impossible to define that in, you know, an academic study asking stupid questions like, do you believe in God and do you go to church? So it goes back to that thing of nobody knows what they're talking about when they're talking about theology. And I'm really glad you mentioned God with a capital G, because I never capitalize God when I'm writing it, because it's not a proper noun. It's not somebody's name. It's like Seth. It's, you know, it's the name of a concept. And I actually posted this in a Facebook group the other day called Theology Forum that I thought was a group of educated academics talking about theology. Turns out it's not, but somebody said, of course you have to capitalize God. It's the God. It's the only God. It's him. He, the God, blah, 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 blah. And I went, no, it's not anything like that. There is no God like that. There's only these ideas that we have projected from our own personalities onto all the gods. Gods, you know, in all the ancient cultures, you know, Greek and Egyptian and Roman, they behave like humans. And by the time Yahweh was created, it was the ultimate projection of human characteristics and human behavior onto this God image, because we need something to blame. And we need something to also give credit for when things are good. So when things are bad, we blame God. When things are good, we thank God. We had to create that for some reason. Now, if only we could take that concept and strip away all the religious narrative that goes with it, all the certainty and requirements and purity tests for belief and the whole concept of belief, we might be able to see it as just a neutral form of, I don't know, cosmic juice, energy. I don't even want to say energy, because that even sounds too woo.
You and I could probably do a 10-hour car ride, challenging each other, asking questions of each other, exploring these conversations. But I mean, wow. I'm talking here with Dr. Terry Daniel, an end-of-life advisor, interfaith chaplain, and founder of the Conference on Death, Grief, and Belief. Quickly, let's roll back to the word spiritual. I heard someone say, and I kind of like this, that for lack of better language, sometimes we non-religious people will use the word spiritual to try to describe the transcendent moments in our lives. You know, if I can't find another word, but, you know, my son was born and it was the greatest day of my life. Or I remember I was driving in, you know, this beautiful mountain range, and I can't describe how gorgeous the vista was. It just struck me. I got goosebumps, you know, and those types of moments. I fell in love in a way I'd never fallen in love before. The word spiritual becomes a tool for them, a kind of a subjective describer of these transcendent experiences. Would that be fair?
I think it is that way for a lot of people. I wouldn't describe those as spiritual, but they are transcendent peak experiences that are, you know, beyond our ordinary reality. So you have moments that are, you know, beyond ordinary reality, just like you would experience on psychedelics. I mean, we're beginning to now allow research on psychedelic therapy into the mainstream psychology and medical worlds. And I don't know if you've ever done psychedelics, Seth, but
no, I have not. I mean, I've spoken to people who take those long trips, you know, and they're big fans, you know, they're big fans. But no,
because it takes you out of ordinary reality into different reality is really the best way that I can say it, into a numinous space.
Now, hang on. Would a better way to say that be a perceived reality? I mean, because when I hear you say that, I'm like, you've transcended this plane and now you're floating out in the cosmic ether thanks to this psychedelic. So that's a leap I'm not quite taking. I mean, could you flesh that out?
You're definitely not floating out in the ether.
Okay.
But it, how do I describe psychedelics? It's a different sense of yourself. It's yourself without attachment to your identity of yourself. How can I say that? It's not, you know, oh, I'm Terry. You know, I'm a 69-year-old, you know, human being living on Earth in Portland, Oregon. All of that stuff goes away. And it's sort of like the boundaries disappear and you have this, every word I say is going to sound so woo-woo, but it is really a sense of interconnectedness with.
I'm not going to hold you to the semantics as much.
No,
I get the spirit of what you're saying.
Yeah, it's the sense of oneness with everything. And so let's go back to like pre-Christian, pre-Judeo-Christian, pre-monotheism. This was this numinous, I love that word, I'd rather say that than mystical or mystical sense, that, you know, the sages and the mystics and the shamans and all the people way back since the first human beings looked at the sky and wondered what the stars were, there was this sense of something that was different than what we normally feel inside our bodies and our egos. That would probably be a good way to say it.
Yeah, but I mean, perception versus reality becomes another problem. Again, you and I could take a 10-hour car ride and we could still be talking about this stuff.
Let's do that. I'd love to do that.
Which is not really the focus. I mean, I want to try to reel us backward a little bit. So do you pray with people? You know, if I'm, let's say I'm a devout Muslim or, I mean, I don't know.
I never do. And that's, you know, that's one of the things that kind of makes me unique as a chaplain. So I also train chaplains. I teach at a seminary and I have students that are going into chaplaincy and I tell them, I do not recommend that you ever offer to pray with a patient because we do not know what anybody else's image of God is. And so I used to think when I was just starting out in this field that, you know, I was, every student of chaplaincy worries about this. The first question they ask is, how do you pray with people? You know, and I used to think that if I was in a room with a Christian, it says on their chart that they're Christian, and they asked me to pray, I could just sort of, you know, say some sort of loving affirmation of seeking inner strength and tag at the end of it, in Jesus' name, amen. And that would satisfy them.
Yeah.
And I realized very quickly how much bullshit that was. But no, I don't pray. I don't pray.
Well, how do you defer? I'm a devout Christian and I'm terrified of death or whatever. Please, can you pray with me? I mean, what's the response from your part?
Here's exactly what I would say. I would say, okay, I understand that prayer would be comforting for you right now. How do you like to pray? That's what I teach my students. Ask them how they pray. What language do they use? And in doing that, you actually get them to say the prayer so that you don't have to. They'll go, well, you know, I like to pray to Jesus and ask him to heal my cancer. Okay, well, what would you say to Jesus if you could say that to him right now? And then they start praying, and I just kind of stand there and listen. And I feel like if that is giving them some peace right now, I'm not going to talk them out of it. I wouldn't try to talk them out. They're on their deathbed, you know. This is the hard thing, okay? This is the big challenge of chaplaincy, is to not try to educate, not try to counsel, not try to talk anyone out of their beliefs. Because they're dying. They're taking their comfort anywhere they can. And who am I to say that they should think different, especially if they're 80 years old and they've been this way their whole lives? I can't talk them out of it. That said, there's only one time when I would ever try to talk them out of their beliefs, and that's if they're afraid of going to hell. And I'll give you an example. A chaplain friend of mine did this. You're never supposed to do this, but he did. He had a dying man who was very afraid of hell. And as this man went deeper and deeper into his dying process, and he was, you know, kind of unconscious and non-responsive, my friend whispered in the guy's ear, "There is no hell. You've been told this all your life. It isn't true. Where you're going right now is not that place. I don't know where it is, but you're at peace. And you will be at peace, and hell doesn't exist." And he said that into the guy's ears. He was dying. That's about what I would do.
I think, too, that speaks, and I've seen like sometimes in the atheist movement, quote unquote movement, because there's so many gears in that machine. But, I, you know, there are some hardliners, I think, who, you know, if they're at a funeral and somebody prays or mentions that they're up in heaven or whatever, they can be pretty awful at choosing their battles. Right. Mm-hmm. We need the time and place. This is not necessarily the time to grab somebody by the shirt collar and say, there's no evidence for the Christian heaven. You know,
right.
It becomes counterproductive. And in many ways, it's not humanistic. It's not the compassionate thing to do. I remember having the conversation on a show a while back, and forgive me if you've heard this, but back when my father was dying, he passed away recently, and I was going through the hypothetical, what if in his last moments he was so desperate to rescue me from hell? Like, you know, one of the last things he was thinking of is, oh my God, I'll never see my son again. He's going to go to hell, because he was a Bible literalist. If he asked me at his deathbed to say a salvation prayer, wouldn't the compassionate thing be to actually mimic that with him, to give him a little bit of relief? Could I play act? Is that the compassionate mm-hmm. thing to do? And I didn't really come to an answer on that. But the reason I asked the question is because I thought, well, is this really the hill I want to die on? Like, who's it really affect? You know, there's no one else in the room. It's just him and me. How do I give comfort in his final minutes, kind of thing? I don't know. I'm just babbling, Dr. Daniel. Do you have any thoughts on that?
No, that's exactly right. But, you know, it takes a lot of guts to do that. And, you know, the question is, do we want to support somebody when they're dying, or do we want to be right?
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And like you said, that's not the hill you want to die on. And, you know, it's painful for me when I see people struggling like that. But I know it's not my place to change their lifetime theology in the last week of their life,
yeah.
unless they want to. And sometimes they do want to. Sometimes they will be questioning and they will ask for some guidance, and I'll be all over that. You know, I do a lot of counseling with people who are facing death, who are really interested in unpacking their embedded theology. And here's a term that you'll find interested, embedded versus deliberative theology. So embedded is the one you grew up with as a kid that they, you know, put into your brain. And deliberative theology is when you've actually used your critical thinking skills to try to figure it out, chop it to pieces, deconstruct it, and reconstruct it again. And I'll always support anybody who wants to do deliberative theology.
I really like that idea. One of the ways I approach a lot of religious people when they find out I'm non-religious is, instead of playing to this negative idea of what a non-Christian might be, because everybody around me is Christian, I like to flip it and say, well, actually, I give you more credit than I think you may be giving yourselves, because according to your Bible, there is no one worthy, no, not one. And that beyond Christ, you are deserving of hell. You were born infected with original sin. I don't think that. I think you have value in your own life for your own sake, by your own standards, in your own way. You know, I don't see someone who is unworthy. I look at you and I think you have tremendous value. And I've always found that's a great way to flip the hell concerns on their ear.
Does it work? Does it actually flip it for them?
I don't change minds with it. What it does, though, is it de-escalates and it helps to destigmatize me as someone in opposition to their faith. You know, a lot of times people walk in and they've sort of proverbial got their arms folded, and they immediately, the amygdala fires up and, oh God, there's somebody here who's an atheist. And instead of me saying, well, what you believe has been totally debunked, it's damaging, destructive, and ridiculous bullshit, which I think it very much is that. But instead of saying that, and they totally double down and freak out and it becomes a moment of conflict, I try to keep it positive and I'll say, well, actually, I'd like to give you more credit than you may be giving yourself, because I don't think you are a sinner. I don't think you need someone else to give you value or worth and or purpose, you know, and it surprises people when they hear that. So it's more of a de-escalation thing, and maybe it's a seed that can be planted that they'll think about later on.
I hope that is true. You know, what I do when people are open to considering that, I'll tell you a story I use a lot in my classes. So I had this man in the hospital. he had just gotten a life-threatening diagnosis, and he said to me, you know, I was a real bad dude all my life. I beat up women. I was a meth dealer. You know, I sold meth to teenagers. You know, I was a criminal. I was a really bad guy. And I was a biker, and I would, you know, cruise around the country with my guys, and we'd camp in all these different places. And one day at an encampment, there were these Christians, and they were having this tent meeting, and I went in there, and I got saved. But then I went back to my criminal life, so because it didn't really change anything. And now here I am, I'm dying, and I want to ask you, Chaplain, am I still saved? Am I going to go to heaven because I went to that revival meeting and got saved, even though I still did all this bad stuff? So what you do is similar to what you just described. You turn their faith back on them. You throw it back in their lap. And so what I said to him was, well, are you still a Christian? Do you still believe in that? Yeah, I still believe in that. Okay, well, what does your belief system tell you? What does your faith tell you? Well, my faith tells me that as long as I've got Jesus, I'll be forgiven and I'll go to heaven. So right there, he sees the cognitive dissonance in his thinking. So I said, okay, well, then what are you worried about? You're good to go.
I'm talking here with Dr. Terry Daniel, and I've got more questions. Are you good for time?
I am.
Because I've got a list of it. Because I want to talk about religious trauma. I want to talk about constructive versus destructive ways of dealing with grief. Because I know, I mean, we can screw ourselves up. I want to talk about rituals. I got a few things I want to address. So we'll continue with Dr. Terry Daniel in just a second. Hang on. Talking here with Dr. Terry Daniel, who is the founder of the Conference on Death, Grief, and Belief. There's a website for that, deathgriefandbelief.com. It's going to be in Portland, July 15th through the 17th. Dr. Daniel's been kind enough to invite me to present. You must have had a shallow bench. You know what I'm saying? I mean, I was like, you want me to come? And because I don't have any great wisdom, I think I probably ask more questions than I've answered. But I know in my own life, with the death of a father, I've navigated some of this. And what I really like about the idea of the conference is it's not exclusive. I mean, you have a lot of people, a lot of different perspectives. And I think we benefit from hearing other perspectives. Doesn't mean we blindly accept, but let's talk about these things, right?
Yeah. Speaking of the conference and talking about, you know, how diverse it is, I've got you as a keynote speaker. I have Frank and Dan from Thank God I'm Atheist. Clint Haycock, I don't know if you know him. He's from Wales, and he is a former Bible teacher who runs the Mind Shift podcast, very well known in the atheist community. And I've got also people who I don't know how I can say it, but, you know, accept the idea of the non-physical universe that we're talking about. So, for example, Greg Shushin, who is a researcher, he has done research on near-death experiences and afterlife beliefs across cultures. And so he can tell you, you know, what the ancient Egyptians believed and what the Zulu people in Africa have in their belief systems, and how belief systems actually influence how we experience awareness out of the body. And that has to do with, you know, dreams or out-of-body experiences or places that we go when we're in a coma. So we've got guys like that too. And we have your friend Josh Bowen also, who's going to be there.
Yeah, he's author of the book, The Atheist Guide to the Old Testament. And he's an expert in the Sumerian civilization and the biblical OT. He's a great guy. He'll be a great addition.
He's wonderful. And, you know, I love having, you know, religious scholarship like that, because we have to, you know, if we're going to deconstruct from biblical literalism, then we need guys like that to tell us how this stuff was written, why it was written, what the agendas of the writers were, the political climate of the time, because it's all political, especially the OT, which really doesn't have anything spiritual in it. It's politics and real estate, essentially.
And genocide, yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah, it's crazy. Let's talk a little bit about your past. Do you come out of fundamentalism?
Not at all.
I mean, do you look at the rest of us and think, what the hell is wrong with you? Seth, you used to think donkeys could talk. What's wrong with you, Seth? Does that ever cross your brain?
No, I'm not that kind of judgmental person at all. I feel sorry for people that, you know, came out of that. And it breaks my heart because it is religious trauma. It is child abuse that you and others raised in those kinds of settings were experiencing. I had a very different experience. My family were secular Jews in Los Angeles, and they cared nothing about the theology. They didn't know anything about the Old Testament. It was just a social thing for them. We didn't go to religious services except when there was a party, like a bar mitzvah or a wedding was the only time we ever went in a synagogue. Hanukkah had 8 days, so the kids got 8 presents. And when I was about 13, I once asked my dad, a Holocaust survivor, where do Jews go when they die? And he said, to the Cadillac dealership.
Okay.
So that was my religious education as a child. But I was always super interested in it. And my father, who was pretty much an intellectual, educated man, he had these books on religion. He had this little boxed set of books of the 5 major religions. And I read them or tried to read them when I was about 12 years old. And he also had Carl Jung, you know, Man and His Symbols. And I read that. I was pretty precocious. I was just interested in this stuff because I wanted to know what all the fuss was about. I didn't know any fundamentalist Christians growing up. If they were, they never talked to me about it as a child. I didn't start even hearing about that until later in life, but I had this fascination. And then when I was about 16, I went and I got a Bible somewhere. I don't know where I got it. We didn't even have one in my house. And I decided to start reading it to see what all the fuss was about. And I knew immediately that you were supposed to read between the lines, that the language and the stories were symbolic and not meant to be taken literally. I knew that at 16. So it became kind of a passion of mine. I'm 69 now. I've been interested in this for years. And the way I got to where I am now is in 2006, my son died. He was 16. He had a rare metabolic disorder. He was severely disabled for the last half of his life. And then he died. And being present for his death, all the grief and pain aside, was a very profound experience for me because it was like watching him being born, except this time I was watching him go away. And there was something about it that had that sort of numinous, mystical feeling to it. And I decided I wanted to be around that more. So I became a hospice volunteer. And I did that for about a year, and I realized that all these hospice patients were having these spiritual crises. They were freaking out because of their belief systems about hell and punishment and sin. And I felt sorry for them, seeing them in pain like that, and I wanted to have conversations with them about those concerns. But as a volunteer, you're not allowed to talk about spiritual things because you have to have all kinds of training to do that. So at age 56, I decided to go back to school and get a degree in religious studies and get the necessary training to become a chaplain. And I did that only because I wanted to enter into these deep existential conversations with these patients. That was the whole reason I did it. And after a while, I realized that I didn't only want to be a chaplain. I wanted to teach in that world so that I could further critical thinking in people that were going out into the world to be chaplains. So I am kind of infiltrating, I guess you could say.
I don't want to... I feel like I'm peering in your windows. You tell me where the boundary is here. But when your son passed away, what's happening in your heart? There is not language really probably to describe the grief you felt. But walk me through kind of that journey.
I don't mind talking about it at all.
Okay.
It was 15 years ago, and you know, he was diagnosed when he was 10. And so since from age 10 until age 16, I knew he was going to die. So I had a lot of time to prepare for it. And I also prepared him for it. I realized very quickly that little kids, everybody in our culture really, has no exposure to a healthy way of looking at death, or I should say very little exposure. And I thought, you know, here's a 10-year-old kid. Everything he knows about death, he's seen from movies and video games, which is like violence and people screaming and blood, you know. So I wanted to teach him to not be afraid of death. That was the first thing. And I went to the library and I found all these beautiful books about Native American traditions and Buddhist ideas. And I read him all these stories and, you know, about other realms that you can go to, you know, other ways of looking at death. And I realized that when I was doing that with him, I was really doing that for myself. And of course, you know, of course it was terrible losing him, but he was so sick and so uncomfortable. And by the time he died, he was 16 years old. He'd been wearing diapers for the last 4 years. He couldn't talk. He couldn't walk. He couldn't feed himself. He couldn't move his body. I was happy to let him go. And I like to think that he was happy too. But at that point, he couldn't express it. He couldn't articulate because he had really lost most of his ability to speak. So I was very much at peace with it. And I feel like I was privileged to be able to look at it that way compared to so many other people who lose children unexpectedly in school shootings and car accidents and horrible things. I can't even imagine what that's like. But when I talk to parents who've experienced that, and I do talk to them quite often, they say the same to me. I can't imagine what it's like to watch your child die for 6 years. So you can't compare those two things. You can't describe grief, just like you can't describe love. But something that I've learned, and I'm really glad you asked about this, is my doctoral dissertation was on toxic theology as a contributing factor in complicated grief. So all of this experience I had led to the work that I'm doing now. What I was finding working with grieving people is if they had a religious belief like suicides go to hell, and their loved one died by suicide, they were not healing. They were not making progress in returning to equilibrium and restoration after the loss, because they were spending all their thought processes on wondering if their loved one is in hell and I'm never going to see him again and he's burning for eternity because he's a suicide. I've seen so much of this that that became my new direction. And now I look at everything that I've been through in my life, starting with my non-religious upbringing, my passionate curiosity about religion, my experience with my son's death, and then my education in religious studies, all kind of led to this and to this conference that I'm putting on and to the work that I do now and my new book, which is called Grief and God, When Religion Does More Harm Than Healing. And that kind of segues us more into toxic theology, which is where all my focus is right now. And what I try to teach my chaplaincy students how to deal with toxic theology when they encounter it, because they will.
I think that in the United States, we have a death dysfunction. We don't want to talk about it. We're scared of it. While other parts of the world are, and they have a healthier approach. And we talk a lot about death with dignity and medical aid and dying. This is a taboo, right? We're playing God. But, you know, when I would rather take control of how I exit than wallow and languish and come to the point where I'm not really living. I'm just drawing breath. I'm just existing. But we got a real dysfunction here in the United States.
Oh, boy, do we ever. And that's getting better because we do have, you know, death with dignity now in several states. I have seen people who I've worked with people who are doing it. I was with a woman just a couple weeks ago, a couple days before she was scheduled to do death with dignity. And I visited her as a chaplain. We had a fabulous conversation, and she said everything that you just said. You know, she had just been diagnosed with something horrible. She knew what the future was going to look like. And she said, where do I sign? And 3 days later, they came and gave her the medicine, and or she took the medicine herself, and she died in 10 minutes. And I think it was one of the most beautiful things I ever saw.
Well, plus, you know, on her terms, she can choose to be surrounded by, you know, the people of her selection, whether it's family, friends, she can, I think what I was surprised to hear about as we had approached medical aid and dying is there's a comfort that comes. Like a lot of these people who take control of their exit, actually, that's part of their comfort mechanism at end of life. They feel better about things. I don't know how else to say it.
That's absolutely correct. Absolutely. There are some limitations, though, and this is, you know, we still have to work out the bugs on this. So you have to be physically able to take the medicine in your hand and put it to your mouth and drink it. I think you even have to mix it up yourself. I'm not really sure how that works.
In some states, yeah. I think different states have different requirements or guidelines on that. So,
but I do think in every state, somebody cannot administer it to you. And you have to be able to ingest it and administer it yourself. And if you can't, if you've had a stroke and your hands don't work or something, you can't do it. They won't approve you for it. You also have to be in your right mind. So if you have dementia, you can't say to your caregivers, I want to do with death with dignity. They will not. It's not considered a legitimate request because you're not of sound mind. So there's all these limitations that we still need to work around, find a way to fine tune it.
Well, and many of the objections are religiously based, fundy religiously based.
And that's such an interesting thing, not only with death with dignity, and it's such a ridiculous argument, right? It's like, well, you can't do that because you're playing God. You know, only God knows when you're going to die. Well, if that's true, then you should never have surgery or take antibiotics either.
Talking here with Dr. Terry Daniel, talk to me a little bit about constructive versus destructive ways of dealing. And I guess in my mind at the moment, I'm thinking about bottling up. Some of this speaks to the old school man's man model. You know, men don't cry. And I've got a guy in my mind. He's in his late 60s and his mother dies, right? And he, you know, he goes outside, smokes a cigarette and he betrays no emotion. It's all bottled up because men don't do that. He's not, because that's weakness. And I think that exists in a lot of forms. If I reveal where I'm at, if I'm vulnerable, if I crack, that's a problem. So walk me through this extremely broad sort of issue of destructive versus constructive ways of coping with this monumental loss.
Yeah. This guy that you're talking about, is he a Christian by any chance?
Yes, he is.
Okay. So I'll come back to the gender side of it in a minute. There actually is something in the fundy world that they consider, they call it appropriate Christian grief. I'm sure you know, you've heard of this because it was in one of Paul's writings. We should not grieve like others, right? Where does that come from? You probably know it better than I do. Where he said, well, because we believe that when we die, we're going to be in heaven with Jesus, we shouldn't grieve when our loved ones die because that means we don't have faith in our faith. And a lot of Christian fundies actually really believe this, that to show sadness means that you don't really believe the doctrine. And of course, the doctrine isn't true. So you really do have this cognitive dissonance, this conflict. So your friend who was out there smoking a cigarette, besides the gender stereotypes that he was probably trying to stick to, he might have also been trying to exhibit proper Christian grief, where you don't grieve because you should be happy that your loved one's in heaven. I remember when the last pope died, or maybe it was two popes ago, I guess in the 90s, I don't know which pope it was, but millions, literally millions of people came to the streets of Rome, gathered around the Vatican for his funeral, and they were crying. And I saw this on television, and I thought, why are these people crying? This is the Pope. If anybody's going to heaven, it's him. So they should be happy, right, according to their belief system.
Now, to be fair, though, I mean, are they weeping because, not the Pope, but, you know, if someone in a family sees someone else pass away, are they grieving the fact that they miss them? They won't see them even on the order of decades? I mean, that's fair, right? Somebody
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. And that's normal, healthy grief.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Of course we're supposed to feel that, which is why this Christian grief idea is so unhealthy. Because if you are a literalist Christian and you believe that biblical edict that came from Paul, then you're crying and grieving because your spouse died, and at the same time, you're feeling guilty for crying and grieving.
Are there ways that people deal or don't deal with this that screw them up in their brain? I mean, they damage themselves psychologically, whether it's bottling up or maybe they engage in some destructive behaviors. What are some of the warnings you might have from your experience?
Yeah, good question. So what you're talking about is what we call complicated grief. So in normal grief, over a period of time, you go through certain processes we call tasks of grieving. Having remembrance of the person, constructing a new life without the person, building a new identity, feeling your pain, doing your grieving, connecting with other people, being in community. There's all this stuff that's part of the healing process. If you don't do that stuff, that's when you get into a thwarted process where there's a complication. It's just like if somebody has a surgery and they get an infection, the doctor will say, well, the surgery went well, but there were complications. Same kind of thing. There are complications. There's a long list of things that add to these complicating factors. Like if you are a person who isn't good at expressing yourself verbally, you can't talk about your feelings easily, you don't have anybody to reach out to support you, you don't have friends and family to help you out, or if it was an unthinkable death, like a child shot in a school shooting, and the trauma is so huge and the intrusive images in your mind are so big and you don't get proper help with processing that, there's a long, long list of things. And yeah, you get into what is called complicated grief, and it can be debilitating for the rest of your life. And one of the factors that contributes to that is religious belief. So if you believe in this, you know, appropriate Christian grief idea that we just talked about, or if you believe in hell, let's say, you know, you're an evangelical Christian and you have a gay son who died of AIDS back in the AIDS days, you're going to think he's in hell for being gay. And so you're grieving your son, but you're also grieving the fact that you literally think he's burning in flames and suffering for eternity. So that's going to screw up your healing from grief. Absolutely. And back to the gender constructs you mentioned earlier with your friend. Before we became a little bit more enlightened about gender, as we are now, we used to say that men grieve a certain way and women grieve a certain way. Men don't cry, women do. And now what's coming forth in the grief counseling world is that this is not gender specific. There are styles of grieving, and they've been kind of identified as instrumental versus intuitive. So an intuitive griever is the person who really feels their feelings, who cries a lot, who talks about it a lot, who just really lets themselves sink into deep, deep emotion about it. That's an intuitive griever. Other people don't grieve that way, and it's not gender related. Some people grieve in the instrumental fashion. That's the kind of griever I am. What I do, yes, I feel my emotions. Yes, I cry, but I go out and start a foundation or go to school and get a degree or start a podcast. I do things. Those are pretty grandiose examples, but you know, some grievers deal with their pain by going and cleaning out the garage, or building an addition on the house, or, I don't know, changing their wardrobe.
Is there a danger, though, that someone might be keeping themselves busy, doing some sort of a, not just physical, but emotional busy work to keep themselves from dealing with the realities?
Yes and no, it depends. And so that's when we start looking at those other factors that add to complicated grief. Like, are they talking about their feelings? Do they have social support and people around them? Even though they're out there, you know, banging away in the garage all day, when they come in at the end of the day, can they sit down with their wife and talk about their feelings or talk about the one that was lost? Or are they shutting everything out? That's a little bit different. That's not necessarily instrumental grieving. That's where it becomes complicated. So, for example, you know, I work with a lot of people who've had children die because that's a space that I know well. And I try to tell them there's something, you know, that's relatively new in psychology called continuing bonds. And we learn this from other cultures, that when somebody dies, the relationship doesn't end. You still have a relationship with that person. And I'm not talking metaphysical woo-woo stuff here, but that person's role in your life, the feeling of them, the knowledge that you have of them, the awareness of their presence is always there. So I have people do things like, you know, if it's Christmas and it was your kid who died and he really loved Christmas, don't throw away Christmas because of that. Still have Christmas and bring him into it. You know, have a Christmas dinner with your family and put a picture of the kid on the table. Make and light some candles around it or something. Bring him into your life. Don't feel like you have to cut them out of your life. And so that kind of stuff helps. So the griever who's not willing to do that is just probably cutting off their feelings and not dealing with it. And we also have something called spiritual bypassing, which is something that Christians do a lot, which is, well, I'm not sad because he's in heaven. And so that's another way to avoid dealing with the grief. And New Age people do that too. Oh, I'm, you know, this is how it was meant to be. His soul planned in this incarnation to leave at this age so that he could be a guide to the rest of us from the other side. That's also spiritual bypassing.
This speaks a little bit to ritual, which is kind of my, I want to cap our conversation with that in just a second, plus whatever final thoughts you have. But do you hold to the quote unquote five stages of grief? You know, this denial, anger, bargaining, depression, acceptance. This is the standard thinking about grief. Do you hold to that?
Nobody holds to that anymore.
I hear it a lot. Oh, which stage of grief are you going through that? You're saying totally nobody in the psychological world holds to
nobody.
That.
Nobody. Nope. That theory was thrown out a long time ago. Unfortunately, it became very popular, and it's another thing that causes a lot of problems with grief because people expect to be going through these stages, and if they're not, then they think something's wrong, or they sort of push themselves into these stages. You know, that theory was created by Elizabeth Kubler-Ross, and she was interviewing patients in a hospital that were facing their own death. And what she really did in that research, which was not bona fide academic research, it was just an informal survey she did, is she found that these dying people had a certain set of common responses. And so very commonly there was denial, very commonly there was anger, depression, and all of that. So she put it together in this book and she called it stages of grief. But it was never meant to be sequential stages. First you do this, first you do that. And it was unfortunate that she used the word stages because she should have called it responses. So those five things are possible responses, but there's unlimited other responses like anxiety, blame, guilt, relief, exhilaration. You know, there's happiness, there's sadness, there's all these different feelings. And so that's what really happens. And the sad thing that happened with Elizabeth Kubler-Ross is, not sure, I guess maybe 10 years after her book came out, she connected with a guy by the name of David Kessler who wrote a book with her called On Grief and Grieving, which was a spinoff on her title, which was called On Death and Dying. And he, with her blessing, took her five stages and attached them to grief and grieving. And that's how it got so popular that everybody knows it.
Yeah, still embedded in the zeitgeist. Everybody talks about which stage of grief. They probably punish themselves if they don't have
exactly,
you know, whatever that is in whatever order it's supposed to be. I'm broken. I don't have these stages in this order. Let's talk about ritual as we draw this conversation to a close. I interviewed Sasha Sagan, the daughter of the late cosmologist Carl Sagan, recently, who wrote a book on rituals. I know that, you know, we talk about the secular Jews, Judaism, where roughly, 50% of Jews say that they have some questions about even the existence of God, but they are practicing. They are attracted to the structure, the ritual, the traditions. There's comfort. I call it the frame for the human experience, or frames. Talk to me about the benefit of rituals.
Oh, I'm so glad you asked. That's one of my great passions, and it's also a class that I teach at the seminary right now on rituals. I urge people to sort of move away from the traditional religious rituals and to create them from scratch. but also using elements from other cultures. So in my workshops and teachings that I do on rituals, I bring in a little something from the shamans of Peru. I bring in a little something from Africa and from China, a little Jewish, a little Christian. I throw them all in there and take bits and pieces and create little rituals and teach people how to do that. Ritual is absolutely necessary in our life because it gives form to the formless. You cannot express in words how it feels for your child to die, but you can express it using representational objects, art therapy, drawings. Just as a short example, one of the things that we do in my ritual workshops that I learned from the shamans is when you have extreme trauma and extreme anxiety, you pick up a rock and you blow really hard into the rock all your pain, all your anger, all the stuff that you're holding in your chest. And literally by blowing out air forcefully, you're actually doing breath work. You're opening your lungs and you're opening your chest, because when you're grieving, you really don't breathe properly. You close up around that little broken heart and everything just shuts down and you breathe shallow. So blowing into the rock opens up your chest and, you know, I'm so angry and why did this happen? You died too soon. I'm mad at God. And then you take the rock and you go and throw it in a river or you bury it in the earth. And symbolically, and I think energetically, what that does is it removes all that pain and trauma from your body and puts it outside your body, puts it someplace else, because trauma lives in the body. Trauma is a physiological condition, not a psychological condition.
Dr. Terry Daniel, anything else that I've missed before we wrap it up?
I do want to say that I have a special discount code for your listeners if they want to come to the conference.
The website for that, deathgriefandbelief.com, coming up July 15th through the 17th. What's the code and how do they use it?
So it's in Portland, Oregon. And if you're coming to the conference in person, where you can meet Seth Andrews in person, when you register for the general admission ticket, put in the promo code atheist and you will get $30 off.
I'm looking forward to that. I'm also interested in, you know, what the conversations at the convention hall bar are going to sound like when you get all these different perspectives, backgrounds, attitudes, personalities together. And I'm looking forward to that. I think it's going to be awesome.
Hanging out at the bar is built into the conference schedule. That's like part of our scheduled activities.
It's yes. Part of my ritual. I don't even really drink, but it's part of a ritual that you and I will participate in. Dr. Terry Daniel, I will include her links in the description box of this broadcast. I'm thankful for you and the work that you do. And this is a critical, I think, important and beneficial conversation about what for many is a very difficult topic, and sort of destigmatizing it, I think, is one of the first steps. And so you're greatly appreciated. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Seth. This has been great.
Follow The Thinking Atheist on Facebook and Twitter. For a complete archive of podcasts and videos, products like mugs and t-shirts featuring the Thinking Atheist logo, links to atheist pages and resources, and details on upcoming free thought events and conventions, log on to our website, thethinkingatheist.com.